Monday morning. You're on the train to work, your mind flooded with all the things you have to do today. You look up at the poster in front of you selling a delicious dish of food. At least you know what to have for lunch today.
You arrive at the station and head towards work. And suddenly it hits you. That musical earworm from the advert last night. Catchy and easy to remember, you hum along to it, bopping your head, repeating it over and over again. But hold on. What was it advertising?
Lunchtime. Hungry and needing to make a choice quickly, you wonder what to eat. The poster on the train. You remember that delicious dish, and it's exactly what you're in the mood for. But what was it called? What did the logo look like? Sound familiar?
What is it about adverts that stick out in our memory? And how does a brand convert a viewer or a listener to an actual customer?
We tend to romanticise the past, but was branding really better back then? Or do we only choose to recall the good stuff?
Maybe you remember the Hovis advert with the boy wheeling his bike up the hill. Or maybe your mind goes to an elegant soiree at the ambassador's official residence.
So what are the features that these campaigns share? And how do we harness the power to ensure that brands of today are as successful as those of the past? Hello and welcome to How to Hack the Brain. I'm Ziba Goddard.
And I'm Raffi March. This is the podcast where we figure out how to solve your everyday problems using behavioural science as our guide.
In today's episode, we're going to explore the nuances of brand awareness so that you've got the power to make your brand memorable.
We'll be speaking to Charles Valence, founder and chairman of one of the most successful branding agencies in the world, VCCP.
And we'll also be chatting to Katie Hart, who is a consultant, lecturer and public speaker on the fascinating world of neuromarketing.
And then we'll be putting all of our new insights to the test, pitting brand against brand to see which companies have managed to insert themselves into the zeitgeist, become household names and found their way into the hearts and minds of the public.
So have you got any favourite old adverts that have really stuck with you, Raffs?
There is one that pops into my head every time I think about my favourite adverts. And I think it was probably from about 2014. I was still at university. But it was this advert by Honda. And you know car adverts, they tend to be very much, you see the reflection of a car in a shiny window. It's talking about luxury, it's talking about comfort, but it doesn't really go anywhere. It's really hard to bring that to life. This advert was called Keep Up. And essentially, words flashed up on the screen one at a time and you had to read them. And it got faster and faster. And the music built up around it. And then you saw the cars moving across the screen. And what it did was so fantastic because there's a level of engagement that you need to actually read the words. So you can't look away from the screen at any point. But on top of that, you get this almost physiological response. As it goes faster, your heart goes faster, it gets really exciting, and it builds you up to the point where it's almost like you're experiencing what it's like to drive in a car and feel that speed. And I think it's really hard to understand what it feels like to go fast in a car when you're stationary on a sofa. But this helps you to visualize that. So much so that when I was looking up the name of the ad earlier, I found out that the ad in its original form got banned because it was encouraging people to drive faster. So it created such a physiological response that people wanted to go out and get in their car and drive.
Yeah, I mean, even though it had an unintended consequence, I think that's such a clever advert by the way you've described it. Did your stomach actually go a little bit like when you were watching it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even watching it now, it just increases your adrenaline. You want to go fast, you want to do things, and you almost want to watch it over and over again.
Interestingly, last year, 59% of Americans couldn't remember less than 1 in 10 of the ads that they'd actually watched in the last 24 hours. So globally, a staggering 89% of advertising efforts actually fade into total obscurity, as if they'd never existed in the first place. So advertising really needs to catch the eye. And if advertising is what makes you famous, branding is all about what you become famous for. So really, memory is the physics of advertising and branding. But as we know, Raffi, memory is pretty complex. So for brands to become famous, we really need to crack this memory code.
Yes, and in actual fact, we have three types of memory, not just one.
Okay, so talk me through these individually then, Refs.
Okay, so starting with your sensory memory, this is all the information that enters through our senses, so what you hear, see, smell, touch and taste. This information lasts in our sensory memory for less than a second. It's incredibly quick. And if we don't pay attention to it, or if we don't deem it to be important, it's filtered out. If we do think it's important, it goes into our short-term memory. That's why we often refer to it as fleeting impressions. If you imagine you're in a restaurant, it's a real sensory experience. And there are things that you might not be aware of, like the music, that's all being filtered out. But the things that you think are important, like the sizzling plate that's going past you, that might be something that you want to order off the menu, that's what goes from your sensory memory into your short-term memory.
Okay, so what happens once it's been filtered through to our short-term memory?
So the information that sits in your short-term memory lasts for up to 30 seconds, but what's really important is how it starts to make you feel. We often refer to it as an emotional imprint. Emotion is what helps you to encode memory and move from your short-term into your long-term.
Aha, so that's obviously the million-dollar question for brands in that case. How do we encode things in our long-term memory?
Well, it's quite simple, really. There are two ways. It's either through rehearsal or it's through repetition. All other information is forgotten, but once it's in the long-term memory, it can be stored for up to a lifetime. And we often refer to this as a core memory.
Well, that's a fantastic way, Rafi, to lead us into our discussion with Charles Valance. Charles is an advertising guru and founded the UK's biggest creative agency, VCCP. So he's been at the top of the advertising game for well over 20 years. And his business actually created the original conception for the Compare the Meerkat campaign, as well as smash hit campaigns for VMO2, Cadbury's, EasyJet and many others.
Hello, Charles. Could you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about the work that you do?
I'm Charles Valance and I'm a brand strategist in advertising or in communications. And I've been that since 1987 when I came down to London. My current job is I'm a founding partner of an ad agency called VCCP. And I work on lots of different brands, actually, on O2, Virgin Media, Domino's, EasyJet, Primark, Walkers, and a few others.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. So in your experience, what's the key to making brands memorable?
Well, the key task is, and the word is memorability, sometimes known as mental availability, is to have a key, the technical term, or the term that's used in the marketing industry, is a distinctive brand asset, a particular aspect of the brand or element that sticks in the mind, gives you this foothold of memorability. The human mind is officially the most crowded place on earth. You know better than I, Ziba, how many thoughts we have each day. I think it's something like 30,000. It's a permanent battle to get people's attention. And then to get, even if you've got their attention, this is a very, very technical term. What is the thing that sticks in their mind, that gets into their long-term memory? Every brand, you can call it a distinctive brand asset, or quite often I call it a thing. Maybe if you're lucky, you get two or three, but one is a luxury. To get one single piece of memorability, one single fragment or foothold around which all the other associations and perceptions of the brand can agglomerate, aggregate. When you reach back and find and have that retrievability, then all the other thoughts about the brand can assemble themselves. And it seems an obvious thing to say that we need this hook, this distinctive brand asset, also known as a fluent device. And yet, they're very rare. I would say maybe 10% of heavily advertised brands have one. You might ask, well, what are the other brands doing? But obviously, they're not at VCCP. There's the phrase, I think it's from Mark Twain, common sense is as rare as genius. It's so commonsensical that it's rare. And you can tell the brands that have it pretty much instantly. If I say Guinness, you immediately can picture it. It's got one or two distinctive brand assets. If I say Cadbury, if I say EasyJet, if I say Nike, if I say Apple, if I say O2, instantly you're there. And yet, they are the exceptions.
I really like that notion that it's uncommon sense. Can you give me some examples of where you think the thing has been done really well?
Yes. I mean, by definition, if they've been done very well, they're very quick for us to recall and talk about. One of my favourites, partly because I was involved, but not an inventor of it, so I'm not sort of boasting about it, but I just thought it was a brilliant piece of identity design, is O2, because I think it's both cerebral and visual, so it's intellectual and executional at the same time. This notion of digital oxygen, that telecoms and connectivity, pervasive wire-free connectivity, would become a kind of essential part of life. You're going back to 2001 when this thinking was developed. It wasn't clear then that that was going to be the case, but it was a good bet. So then capture that in this brilliant identity that Gary Holt and Martin Lambinan came up with the blue and the bubbles that weren't actually bubbles because they're not underwater yet. They look like they're underwater. Then to capture it in the name O2, register the name against all the odds. It's not an easy thing to register. And he certainly couldn't say oxygen. There's just too many copyright competitors. And I just think that's a brilliant gift for a brand that's starting out in life, to have such a clear and meaningful identity. So that would be one of my examples. Cadbury, the glass and a half out of purple, very, 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 very indelibly branded piece of iconography. You can, as soon as I say glass and a half, you've probably already got a whole bar of dairy milk in your mind's eye. And the way that when we started working with Mondelez, the way that we added to that, well, firstly, we returned them to it because it'd been rather forgotten. And the whole category had become gimmicky and forgettable and transient. And we returned to that thought, but we added in a sort of more emotional dimension, which is about there's a glass and a half, in brackets, of generosity in everyone. So it was a product point, but it was also a human point. And I think that's worked very well. And is a very, very strong distinctive brand asset.
Yeah, I totally agree. So would you say that effective branding is more of an art or a science, or perhaps both?
Well, yeah, it's a craft. So it's a bit of both, yes. And it's very interesting. Crafts need to be guarded, and they have their guilds. And these strong brands need to be protected and looked after and curated well. And there are obviously brilliant client organizations that do it brilliantly. I love Guinness, for instance. I just think it's been a brilliantly managed brand over decades. A lot of the brands that understand these rules become what I call super brands. And that's not a sort of hype term just to sort of make some sort of exaggerated claim. I mean it literally. They are above. They are superior to their competition. They're superior in terms of their engagement. They're superior in terms of their function. And they're superior in terms of their vision. And that's what makes them a super brand. And it's interesting, what comes first, a brilliant identity or a brilliant brand success story? I think they're sort of so intertwined that once you can communicate your brand successfully and you have that real singularity of vision and identity, you succeed. And then it becomes almost self-fulfilling. One of the lovely things about these observations is it's not old school, it's new school. It's not ancient, it's modern. There's brands that were born only yesterday that have these qualities, or brands that were born 200 years, 300 years ago. But Cadbury's just celebrating its 200th year.
So I know lots of people are starting to talk more and more about brand worlds. Can you talk a little bit about what is meant when people talk about a brand world?
Yeah, I mean, the strongest brands live in a world of their own creating. And that's what a brand world is. It's a world that the brand defines. It's not the outside that defines the brand, it's the brand that defines how it presents itself and what it means to the world. So it's very much about an interior, an internal locus of control. What's interesting about these brand worlds, whether you look at an O2 or a Cadbury or a Nike or an Airbnb, is actually those worlds share more in common with each other than they do with their direct competitors. They have none of the codes, none of the conventions, none of the interchangeability that you see in a category. They rise above that category and apply their own rules. And the end result of a brand world is it's so vividly portrayed, the logo and the word mark become entirely unnecessary. You can put your hand over the logo and that brand is still instantly recognizable. And of course, in a world that's more atomized, more crowded, more noisy, that is like having a first-class ticket through life for your brand, that level of recognizability and mental availability.
So what are some common mistakes that you see being made?
Well, the most common mistake by far is having no continuity and no consistency and no integration, and thinking that shoving a logo at the end and or at the start, it's even more, sometimes even more dispiriting. You think, oh, I'll put the logo at the start. That'll really trick them. Unless the branding is inherent, that piece of communication will be forgotten. It won't be forgotten instantly. It might have a short-term impact, but it will not build to anything. When you look back over 5 years and you're £10 million a year, all you'll have for that £50 million is a trail of communication rubble. It won't have built anything. You'll start a new campaign, and that £50 million will have created no residual value. But if you're building a brand world with fluid devices and distinctive brand assets, that £50 million will still be paying off. That is in the bank, and you're building upwards and onwards from it, and you're building a communication where every pound is reinforcing and reinvesting in the brand's ad stock and mental availability.
So talking about kind of pound and spend, what advice would you give to smaller businesses who want to build a strong, memorable brand but might not have a big budget?
Well, the principles are the same as a big brand. I mean, every big brand was a small brand originally. Guinness was a small brand. Apple was a small brand. So, I mean, it's singularity, purpose and vision and positioning, and singularity of identity and expression. That is the key to success. The thing that's very difficult for any company, my company or a consumer branded company or whatever, is to keep giving up on stuff, to have the confidence to make continual sacrifices and focus very clearly on where you want to excel rather than try and cover too many bases and become a bit mediocre. I mean, Dyson was a small brand and now is a huge brand, obviously, but you need that searing, single-minded clarity, I think, to succeed. The only other thing I'd say, which sometimes helps when you're advising a client, is what's the enemy? I think sometimes we're so genteel, we just think, oh, let's fit into this market. But what are you going to take down? What's rubbish? I just think that James Dyson's line was, I just think things should work properly, implying that nothing else does. And Steve Jobs, it just works. Again, with the implicit conclusion is that so much technology doesn't. So what's the takedown? What are you, if you're like, angry about? Not just your nice motivation, but what's the chip on your shoulder? What's the point you're trying to prove? It sometimes helps give some angularity and focus to what you want to do and what you want to say. And the final thing I'd say is I'd go back to that observation at the start. And it's an intellectual point, it's a strategic point, and it's an executional point. What is the one thing, if there's one thing that's left in the mind of your prospect, is it running through everything you do, like the wording through a stick of rock? And if it's not, you won't succeed as a brand. You might succeed as a business, but you won't succeed as a brand in the consumer markets, because there'll be just others that achieve better mental availability, and that'll give them a massive head start over you.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for spending the time, Charles, and talking us through your experience. It's been brilliant.
No, it's a pleasure.
I hope you thought that was as brilliant as me, Rafs. I'm fascinated by this idea of brand worlds and actually what connects all those disparate things that Charles talked about. And I think the answer lies in emotion. And the holy grail is connecting memory with emotion. I know lots of research has shown that emotion plays such a big role for encoding information and really consolidating memories so that we can remember them in the future. But research has shown that we resonate more with stories when the emotion they're portraying matches our mood at the time. So a happy person, for example, will identify more with characters who are really positive and enthusiastic. The one that comes to mind for me is Tony the Tiger from my childhood. But what's more interesting is that when you're in that mood again, you're more likely to remember that brand or product again. So for brands, it's really important to think about what emotion is going to drive the purchase of your product so that you really target that emotion.
You're absolutely right, Zeebs. Emotions act as a really powerful catalyst for encoding experiences into your long-term memory. And if we take a look at the science and the specific brain structures that are involved, this is because emotions trigger your amygdala. And this is an almond-sized brain region that's involved in processing emotion. That part of your brain also interacts with your hippocampus. And this is the center of emotion and memory within the brain. And when these two areas interact, it enhances the consolidation of memories, making emotionally charged events more likely to be remembered than neutral events. So when a brand successfully drives an emotion, it embeds itself more deeply into the viewer's memory.
Okay, so emotion is essentially flagging that the event is important and worth being remembered. And the amygdala is enhancing the hippocampus's ability to encode that brand into our long-term memory. And this means that they're not only more likely to be stored, but also stored far more deeply, making you more likely to remember them in the future.
Yes, and there's actually two key factors when it comes to memory. One is, of course, the intensity of the emotion, but the other is driving the correct emotion. And what's interesting is it doesn't have to be the emotion you expect. So if you think about one of the recent Cadbury adverts, obviously they're experts in the space of driving quite intense emotions. But one of the more recent adverts, where the little girl goes into the shop and spends her pocket money, actually drives a sense of sadness. Not necessarily an emotion that you would associate with chocolate. But of course, the reason that's so smart is because if I'm feeling sad, I now start to think of chocolate and chocolate makes you feel better. There's a science that sits behind that anyway, where it gives you a serotonin boost. But they've tapped into the right emotion, but not necessarily the one you'd expect.
And the way that they actually execute that ad is so beautiful. The silence of those advertising without any background music makes them really stand out amongst a whole bunch of adverts that have jingles and tunes that you associate with them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think adverts often default to happiness and humour, which of course can be really impactful if you think about compare the market and the meerkat that's involved in that. It is funny, and that's something that people remember. What I quite like is the ads that have a sense of surprise. So the recent Samaritans ad has a twist at the end that you wouldn't expect.
Okay, so in summary, you absolutely can't have memories without emotions. And it feels like the emotions are the bridges that connect all the memory structures in our brain. So it can't just be about logos, sounds, colours, or even tone of voice. It's the bridge, the emotion itself that connects all these things that creates a really strong brand.
God, that was a fantastic conversation. There were so many great insights there into how successful brand worlds are built. But what might branding look like in the future? And how can neuroscience inform our decision-making and brand strategies?
Well, earlier we mentioned the term neuromarketing, but what exactly does that mean and how can it help with brand building? Well, to find out the answer to that and much more, we spoke to neuromarketing expert Katie Hart. Hi, Katie. Thank you very much for joining us today. Can you start things off by telling us a bit about yourself and the work that you do, please?
Of course. Yeah, lovely. Thank you for having me on. My name's Katie Hart, and the work I do is providing neuromarketing services. So essentially, that breaks down into working with creative people that may be in-house teams, and either providing them with an expert view, expert opinion, or training all around neuromarketing services. And that scales right up to doing neuromarketing forms of research. So instead of market research, we actually employ neuromarketing methods.
Wonderful. So can you explain a bit about what neuromarketing is and how it differs from traditional marketing, please?
So neuromarketing differs from traditional marketing by applying neuroscience to it. So neuroscience is the study of our nervous system, and a lot of that focuses in on the brain. And with neuromarketing, what we're doing is applying insights from our brains to actually help people to make marketing which is more effective, more engaging, and really to enhance the results that they get from their marketing campaigns. So a lot of it is driven from the fact that we've learned that something like 95% of what goes into all the decisions we make is actually subconscious. So it's below our conscious threshold. So if we diligently do conventional market research and we ask people opinions, we might form a focus group or conduct interviews. At best, we might only be able to interrogate 5% of the reasons that they've made the decisions that they have. But through neuromarketing and employing physiological measures, which pick up on the physiological differences that are going on in the brain and across the nervous system, we're able to actually come to understand that 95%, so the key drivers of our behaviour and our decisions.
Great. Okay, got it. So what are some of the key discoveries that have come out of neuromarketing research then?
We are learning all the time. So there is always something new coming out, which is why it's such an exciting field to be in. I think a lot of the lessons that we've been able to learn quite quickly are things like looking at actually the significance our emotions play when it comes to decision making. So typically we might like to think that we're very intentional, very deliberate and rational when we're making decisions. And actually, when we look at what's going on in the brain, we can see that it is the emotional areas that really light up and that they have a massive influence on the decisions that we make, and indeed a lot of what goes on in the world around us. So it's learning a lot, which underpins perhaps what we might have observed or what we might have noticed, but it's actually giving us the tools and the insights to enable us to understand why our consumers behave in that way and why we see the responses that we do to particular campaigns.
Fantastic. Thank you. So in this episode, we're really interested in how listeners can make their brand more memorable. What can the world of neuromarketing tell us about this, do you think?
There's a tremendous amount that neuromarketing can tell us about this. And some of those, as I said, are about helping us to understand perhaps patterns or behaviours we may have observed before. And some of the insights that neuromarketing gives really enable us to view things in a very different way. So to me, the first key about making sure that brands are memorable is we've got to get them noticed. They've got to be seen. They've got to be recognized within the environment around us. And we all know how complex and fragmented that environment is. But neuroscience teaches us that actually the brain is processing something like 11 million bits of information each second. And at best, we are only consciously going to be able to be aware of perhaps 40 of those. So there is a huge filtering process going on. And neuroscience is helping us to understand actually what meets that threshold, what helps us to ensure that our marketing collateral and the content that we're creating actually gets seen and gets noticed in the first place. So the kind of things that do capture our attention, and again, if we look at what's going on in the brain, it's quite fundamental. It's quite entrenched in our survival. So things that are new, novel, capture our attention. Things that surprise us capture our attention. So it could be sounds that surprise us, or it could even be the absence of sounds. So for instance, you know, campaigns which are going to be rolled out on radio or in podcasts, if they start with a few seconds of silence, that is tremendous in terms of capturing our attention. And you can imagine people working away with that on in the background. When it goes quiet, suddenly our attention is drawn to it in a much stronger way. So a lot of it comes from being able to capture attention in the first place.
Fantastic. So in that case, once we've captured their attention, how can we start to imprint memories?
So we are very entrenched in a digital world at the moment, but actually there is a lot that we can gain by stepping back from that. The sense of touch is very powerful and again reinforces a lot of our memories. So having people hold something or being really deliberate about the packaging that some of our products are created in reinforces the chance of that memory actually being encoded. Smell is another really strong one. Again, you know, if you smell crayons or something, it could suddenly take you back 30 years to your own childhood, or a perfume or an aftershave that somebody that was really prominent in your life might have worn. But also music. And music in a way is a double whammy, because it not only gives us audio, so we can think about some of the jingles that we remember from campaigns or theme tunes from TV shows from years ago. But again, also that music can be composed in a way that it plays to our emotions. It conveys an emotional connection as well. So there's lots that we've learned that we can start to play with when it comes to helping us to really reinforce the memorable nature of our content.
Thank you for that. So what's the value of storytelling then in the context of making brands more memorable for people?
Stories seem to have quite a unique position within our brain. You know, from cave paintings, we've told fables and tales and myths, and, you know, religions are based on the writing and passing on of these stories. They are tremendously important. And I think where they work so well is that they do enable us to create connection. And a lot of the time, what we're trying to do with our marketing communications is to reach out to people, is to create that connection between us and them. And stories have almost an unparalleled ability to do that. So if you think about when you're listening to a story being told, or if you're reading a story, or you know, watching a movie, which essentially is a story as well, we can literally be going through it with the sort of main character. Your heart races as they're in a really terrifying situation, or you might find yourself smiling when something works out well for them. We literally go through that, and our brain mirrors a lot of the behavior we would see if somebody was actually living those stories themselves. So it has incredible strength. Our brain doesn't seem to be able to separate the telling of stories from a lot of our own sort of lived experiences.
Thank you so much for all those rich insights, Katie. That was fascinating.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
So this is one of the things that we often talk about, isn't it, Ziba? So the human mind handles information at different awareness levels. Katie talked about a 95-5% split. Ziba and I like to think about it like an iceberg. So the information that sits on the surface is very easy to access, and that's why people can explain it verbally. It contains all of our conscious beliefs that we make about our behaviour. But it can be quite biased because we post-rationalise. So for example, if I asked you, Ziba, why you bought some chocolate, your justification might be it was on offer. It's a very rational response. So things like focus groups and interviews are useful, but they have their limitations. So there's also all of this information under the surface, and the deeper it is, the more difficult it is to access. So to give you an example, we did a piece of work with Keep Britain Tidy, where we were trying to get smokers to stop putting their cigarette butts on the floor. When we asked people why they did this, they'd often say quite rational things like, there weren't any bins around, so I had no choice but to do it. But actually, when we start to look into the emotions that are at play, the real reason that will stop them putting their cigarette butts on the floor is social influence. They don't want to be seen as a smoker. They don't want other people to dislike them. But obviously that's very hard for someone to say because it's potentially embarrassing and makes them vulnerable.
And I think what's really interesting about this is that it's not that people are lying to us or to themselves. It's actually that they're not able to really truly understand how they actually feel about things. And that's why implicit research gets into the subconscious and starts to tackle actually what's going on that people aren't consciously aware of and can therefore express to us.
So we've spoken to the experts about how successful brands are built and heard about the cutting-edge research happening in neuromarketing. Ultimately, though, real-world recognition and association are what counts in the world of branding. So it's time to go into the wild and test some real people on their brand recognition skills.
Yes, and earlier in the episode, Charles spoke about how the best brands have their mission and purpose running through everything that they do. And he posed a really interesting question. So what comes first, a brilliant identity or a brilliant brand success story? So to gain some insight into this question, we've devised a fun series of tests to explore levels of brand recognition amongst the general public.
We'll be cross-referencing that level of recognition with how people feel towards the brand in general to find out if there's a link between strong, recognisable branding, positive experience of that brand, and warm sentiment towards companies.
So we'll be showing some volunteers a series of visual logos to test how well they know the brands behind them based on visual information alone. And then we'll play them several audio assets from industry leaders. So remember, the question isn't just, do you recognise the brand, but also how do you feel towards that brand?
Finally, we'll ask participants to compare and contrast two well-known brand worlds from the same sector, namely insurance comparison sites. Can you guess which ones might feature heavily?
Could it be a certain Oleg, I wonder? Well, let's go and see. Rafi, over to you in the lab.
We're going to show you a range of different logos, and then I'm just going to point to different ones and ask you to try and say which brand you think it is.
McDonald's, BMW, Nike, Amazon, Unilever, Heinz.
Oh, she's good.
McDonald's, BMW, Nike, Amazon, Unilever, Heinz.
McDonald's, BMW, Nike, Amazon, Unilever, don't know.
McDonald's, BMW, Nike, Amazon, Unilever, Heinz.
Okay, so the first batch of visual logos has near perfect recall. Just one don't know for the Heinz logo. Let's see how they get on with some of the slightly tougher ones.
Oh, I've seen that one. A and E, is that a thing? No, I don't. I feel like there are some that I've never seen.
The United Nations? Oh, I have no idea what that one is. That's Walmart, I think. Ooh, I don't know, like Verizon or something. Ooh, I've definitely seen that one, but I have no idea what it is.
Audi, Shell, not sure. That is Lacoste. Taco Bell, I don't know, not sure. That one is...
Walmart, it's Dove or Nestle. Nestle, Dove, Nestle, final answer. AT&T, no clue. Sorry, Burger King, confidently. Jollibee, because that's from the Philippines. No, sorry, I don't know what that is. No idea. This is getting a lot harder. Is that like Sapporo? It looks like, I have no idea.
Wow, so a real drop off in recognition straight away there.
Oh, it gets much worse.
No.
Jurassic World.
Was the Jurassic World logo in there, Raffi?
It was not. Does Jurassic World even have a logo?
I don't have a clue.
All right, let's move on to the audio asset or iDents section of the test.
So we're now going to play you a series of iDents and we just want you to tell us which brand they are.
Okay.
Here's number one.
Netflix.
Oh, Netflix.
Netflix.
Okay, so very strong brand recognition there from just the sound. Let's see how they get on with the Amazon Prime sound.
All right, second one.
Wow, that's nice, but I've never heard it before.
I don't know. I have heard it, but I'm not sure what it is.
Windows? Microsoft, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, this is so much harder. Apple TV? No.
Oh dear, no right answers at all. Amazon Prime is the second most popular streaming platform in Europe and the Americas, and recognitions drop right off.
Interesting. Well, let's see if there's a correlation between brand recognition and brand sentiment. So we asked participants to give us their general feelings about the brand and a few words that illustrate those feelings.
What springs to mind when you think of Netflix?
I remember just watching Netflix with my cat, like in the evenings. Easy, accessible, fast.
Again, kind of just comprehensive. You kind of, usually on Netflix, you feel like you're going to find something, usually what you need. And kind of cool as well.
Ease of access, lots of choice. It's the default, like it's the first thing that I think of when I want to watch something. So it's just like top of mind.
Pioneering, fast paced.
With Amazon Prime then, what words are associated with that brand?
I think it's harder to browse what you're looking for. So distant, hard, and old.
Bit clunky, kind of a little bit overwhelming. Yeah, I think clunky and variations of clunky is all that's in my head right now, to be honest.
It's not as easy to use as Netflix is.
Consumer focused, better quality, and variety.
So a couple of positive reflections on Amazon Prime there towards the end, but I would say overwhelmingly more positive feelings for Netflix, which tallies with the level of brand recognition as well.
So let's see how they got on with the same audio test, but for some tech brands this time.
Now I'm going to ask you the brands of two other iDents, but these are going to be from a different sector.
No, I don't know that.
Again, I have heard it, I just can't remember what it is.
Okay, sounding like Nokia or something, I don't even know.
Windows. Oh, Microsoft.
Number two.
Apple.
Apple, MacBook noise.
Apple.
Right, so nobody knew the Samsung sound and everybody knew the Apple sound. I think I can see where this is going to go when we ask about feelings towards each brand.
Samsung, how would you describe that?
I don't have a lot to say. I guess I think of just a brand that I don't really associate with.
And it's more functional than cool, like something like Apple.
Affordable, clunky, sacrifice. And I back it. I back the camera. But if I could have afforded an Apple, I would have gotten an Apple. That's tough to deal with, but we move.
How would you describe Apple then?
Like quality, and reliability.
Very cool. Kind of probably just popular as well, to be honest.
Amazing design, seamless to use. I think also, like, it's a habit brand. Like, I have been using Apple for years and I'm very loyal to it, so.
Swish. Expensive. Attractive.
So, as expected, generally negative reviews for Samsung, and there are glowing reflections on Apple as a brand. Again, that's totally in line with recognition of their audio assets.
So now we move on to the final phase of our undercover demo. Here we ask the participants about their feelings towards two companies that offer the same service, but have built quite different brand worlds. We didn't give them any visual or auditory clues here. We just relied on memory alone for them to give us their reflections on each brand.
So if I said the brand, compare the market, how does that make you feel? What springs to mind when you think about that as a brand?
I do think about the Meerkat. It feels like a more close, like I feel more closeness to that brand.
Friendly slash approachable. I think also competent at the same time. You might assume the cutesiness make them seem less competent, but no, I think it just amplifies their brand. It's like it's lodged in after the advert and the meerkats and like the wombat, the more recent character.
I think the meerkat is incredibly funny and generally makes the topic of insurance a lot more sort of lighthearted, I think. I saw their ads a lot before I knew they were about insurance. So I associate Compare the Market with jokes, humor, generally lighthearted emotions. He's a funny guy.
If I ask you about Money Supermarket then, can you say what comes to mind? How emotionally does that make you feel?
I don't think I have an emotional connection to that. Like, I don't feel like there's any emotion. I don't actually remember their ads, if I have to be honest.
I don't even know if I know of a Money Supermarket advert. But just in general, very functional is the one word that comes to mind.
Emotionally, I feel like Money Supermarket is just a bit more straight and to the point. I feel less emotion towards it and more just like, this is the service with a function.
Well, that's pretty clear, isn't it? Lots of positive emotional connection to the meerkats and their colleagues, and some actually fairly cold and vague feelings towards Money Supermarket.
It's so interesting because both companies provide the same service and they've been around for the same amount of time. Maybe it really is just a case of more emotional branding winning the hearts and minds of customers.
Okay, so to summarise on all the brilliant stuff that we've heard and learnt, it's a lot more than just a logo or even a soundbite. And let's talk through some of the psychology behind why some brands really resonated more than others.
So Charles talked about Nike and Apple's brand worlds having more in common than their nearest competitors because they stand out. And this is because of the contrast effect, which has shown that we remember products better when they stand out from their surroundings.
And it's really intriguing that a lot of brand positioning statements only use one syllable. So if you think about it, just do it for Nike, or I'm loving it for McDonald's, or you're worth it for L'Oreal. And there are two reasons for this. The first is that they're processed far more fluently. And this has been shown to not only help us understand, but actually make us love these brands more. In fact, research has shown that simpler sentences are often judged to be written by more intelligent authors, which feels totally counterintuitive when you think about it. The second one is the word length effect, which is a really well-documented phenomenon in psychology where shorter words are typically easier to recall and recognise compared to longer words. And it's simply because we actually have limited capacity, so shorter words just simply occupy less space in our brain.
Absolutely, and we know the thing that's really sticky is when we tie emotion to memory. And tapping into the nostalgia effect is a really great way to do this. Fascinatingly, thinking about the past actually makes us want to spend more money now.
Interesting. So, repetition and rehearsal are two of the key ways to encode into long-term memories. And psychologists talk about the mere exposure effect a lot, which is this simple finding that we like things more the more familiar they become. And what's really interesting is that we actually remember things better when they're repeated over time and across different environments than if we bombard or cram in a short space of time. And this is something known as the spacing effect.
So to summarise, distinctive brand worlds are those that create memory structures in our minds. And what's really important is the connections between those memory structures. We need to create these bridges to take us between the different assets, whether it's logos, sounds, colours, or your tone of voice. And those bridges are formed through emotional connection. That's what's going to bring everything together. So to have a distinctive brand world, drive memory and use emotion.
We hope that through those fascinating conversations, you've got a sense of how memorable brands are created and gained some insight into the cutting-edge research going on around neuromarketing.
Yes, and hopefully you're loaded up with some top hacks to use when building your own brands.
Thanks to Charles Valance from VCCP and Katie for speaking to us. And a big thanks to our own brand demo volunteers.
How to Hack the Brain is a Fascinate Productions podcast for Cowrie Consulting, part of the VCCP group. This episode was produced by Frankie Taylor, Rowan Bishop and Richard Willen.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can press follow to be notified about new episodes and leave us a review to help spread the word.
Thanks for listening and see you next time.